Being a good parent isn't just about having a set of skills or knowing the right thing to do all the time. Ask any good parent you know. They can tell you their pro tips, but most are happy to admit that a lot of parenting feels like winging it. Who we are and how we continue to grow matters because our kids pick up most of what they learn from us by watching how we do things, not by listening to our instructions. So join me on this journey of remodeling our mindsets so that our actions speak to those watching. I'm Dr. Dina Shelton, and this is Remodel Parenting. Welcome back, everyone. We are continuing with our series all about development, and today we are covering early childhood. That is ages 2 through 6. It's a really wide range for a lot of changes during early childhood and right as they get into school years. But there's a lot that's going on during that time that is similar. They just grow so quickly and so much changes from beginning to end of that stage. Just a reminder that we are doing this development series because at each stage that we learn about the development of people, we understand more about our own children, whether we have kids at these stages or if our kids are already through them. We also learn about ourselves and others around us and elements that may be influencing us in our adulthood that resulted from things that we experienced in childhood, because that's very common too. So in the last episode, we talked about infancy, first 2 years, and even some prenatal development. And we did, go into a little bit about how, infants are exploring their environment. They're learning and taking in so much information. But early childhood, if you really think about the most exploratory time of life, early childhood is that time frame. Kids from 2 to 6, that age range is all about doing things to learn. They are exploring, creating, laughing. There's a lot of joy and a lot of play. Through play activities, kids learn things like engagement with others, good social skills, morals, rules, and they begin to develop a framework for engaging with other people. Now, there's a lot of physical and mental development that are going on at this stage. And in each stage, I am covering physical and mental development, cognitive development, and psychosocial development, and hitting all of these aspects for a well-rounded picture of the age group and development. There are big changes in physical growth during ages 2 through 6. The body loses a lot of fat and gains muscle and redistributes it throughout the body. And so you think about, your little baby. I hear people all the time say, they look like a little man or a little lady, or they just start to look so much older, even as they're just going into 2, because they lose that plumpness and the roundness and the protruding belly, and they start to look like a small, full-grown human, right? In such a short time, they are going from unsteady walking and really getting their feet under them to doing cartwheels and kind of bounding around everywhere. So much of that comes from development in areas of the brain that pertain to motor skills, especially gross motor skills like walking and balance and those kinds of things. Nutrition is vital at this point of development. Nutrition is vital at every point of development. Nutrition, sleep, water consumption, those kinds of things. But during this time frame, the 2 to 6, the kids' bodies are primed to really map out how nutrition and metabolism and other types of things are going to work throughout their lives. And so what happens during this time frame and what kids' bodies get used to really helps code for them some of their future nutrition issues, concerns, and maybe even practices. So, for example, in homes where food is scarce, kids learn to eat when food is available. And what happens is they tune out of their body signals to hunger, leading them to overeat and disconnecting them in that area all the way throughout their life. It's hard to reconnect that if eating is not about tuning into what hunger feels like and then meeting and satiating that need, then that propensity to overeat and to overdo food or just to eat when it's available can become a problem. This age group is actually the best time for the prevention of obesity because the brain development is so rapid in setting those maps and tones that if you have your child eating healthy and drinking, learning how to drink water and stay hydrated and staying away from foods that are not helpful to the body, a lot of sugar, things like that, the kid's body adapts to that quickly because it's what the body needs anyway for growth, and it optimizes their abilities to work and to play and to even obey and listen. And how much certain types of food and drink affect kids sometimes would shock parents. And you may have foods and drink that are affecting your kids that you're not really aware of because they haven't been off of them for a while, or maybe they throw a fit if they don't get them. But things like sugar, caffeine, and other types of substances can produce emotional and mental shifts and changes in kids. And so it's just always something to be mindful of and to watch. And the more preventative and proactive you can be, the better it is for your kids long term. Brain growth during this time includes a lot of what they call myelination. I can't talk today. even on podcasts, right? Sometimes this is how it works. Myelin is the substance in the brain that covers the axons, and it's kind of like a lubricant. It helps the brain move information faster. And that information movement is what makes our processing speed happen faster. The faster we can process, the better we can respond and react in situations, and the more we can use other parts of our brain in times of stress and in those responses. But during this age, the two hemispheres begin to connect more through myelination of the corpus callosum, which is that space between the two sides of the brain. And as that space becomes more active with more communication through it, it improves things in the kids like balance. And because we know the left side of our brain controls basically the right side of our body, including the brain areas that are dedicated to logic, reasoning, detailed analysis, basics of language, those types of things. It focuses in on specifics and details. The right side of your brain controls the left side of your body, including areas designated to emotional and creative impulses, artistic abilities, big picture thinking. And so as that corpus callosum and the communication between it is increasing in its myelination, and it is processing faster, then things improve like balance, because when both sides of your brain are talking to each other and talking to each other well, it helps the body counter itself and use both sides in conjunction with the whole body. Here's what's really interesting. You also need that process for emotional balance and regulation. And so both sides of the brain have to be able to talk to one another for emotions to calm down and reprocess. Even some modern therapies like EMDR are designed to activate both sides of the brain and get those processes open and have the hemispheres talking to each other through eye movement or hand stimulators, things like that. And when those processes are open up, the brain hemispheres can talk to one another, and it helps in processing emotions differently, because you've got that emotional big picture and feeling and impulse processes communicating with the logic and the reasoning. It is important to remember arousal and cortisol influence. We talked a little bit about cortisol in the last episode with babies, but when it's activated within a situation, so let's say a fire alarm goes off or a child realizes that they're in trouble, that release of cortisol increases memory temporarily. And so the kids are more likely to learn from their experiences with the stress of a response to something that needs to happen or change. So whether it's danger and a fire alarm, or even if they are not doing something right, no stress in a child's life is not helpful. No stress in an adult's life is not helpful. There's a certain amount of stress, we call it eustress, that we need that helps to keep us going. We'll get too low and we'll kind of bottom out if we don't have that. However, distress or high ineffectual stress is not beneficial to us long term overall. And when kids at this age have a lot of cortisol activated in the aftermath in conversation, so with a lot of grilling from parents or rapid firing questions, a lot of yes or no questions and high expectations, it actually can decrease their memory and make their ability to communicate what's going on decrease significantly, causing more frustration for parents and kid usually. With cognitive development at this stage, the executive functioning is beginning to develop in a significant way. When we say executive functioning, we're really talking about a combination of processes. It's the brain's ability in memory, in inhibition, and flexibility. And when those three areas are strong in their functioning, it provides the ability for the person to anticipate, strategize, and plan for their behavior. And so they can look at and determine and then get the outcomes that they want out of situations, even if something is sprung on them. Executive functioning is important at every stage of development, but it is present and measurable in early childhood. And some people don't realize that, and they may not realize that their children have more of an ability to use that executive functioning if it's being developed and called out and guided in the way that it can be used. It does require other person interaction and stimulation to grow effectively. It's not IQ. It's not like something that is personality and just in us. Executive functioning isn't something you either have or don't have. It's developed over time and it's grown. And then this is a very sensitive time for brain development because these are foundational and required for the rest of life. And you don't get a redo on the first round of executive functioning training. And so to maximize that, it has to be being watched and developed and cultivated in kids. And a lot of that happens naturally if it's not inhibited. There's so much about a kid's life and the world that executive functioning really butts up against if they have the ability to navigate life. But if things change and shift and they're inhibited in that, it can cause issues long term with the overall ability to be developed. Now, with infants, we talked about the sensory motor stage of cognition and how they adapt their reflexes. They have reflexes when they're born, but then they adapt those to get more of what they need out of the world, including to communicate and connect with other people and to make things happen on their own. During this stage, Piaget said that kids move into what he called pre-operational thought. And as opposed to the sensory motor thought in infancy, it includes language and imagination, and particularly kids get the ability for what's called symbolic thought. And that's representations like a flag. When you see a flag, you understand that it represents a country and a people group. Kids that are younger, that they don't have that. A baby can't understand symbolic thought, right? If you tell a kid to think about a shoe, they have an idea and a general understanding of what a shoe is or what a dog is. Where for very small babies in really early toddlerhood that are learning to say things like dog in their mind only means the family dog. And that's right in front of them, that touches them. It's not this more symbolized meaning for all types of dogs and dogs in general and dog breeds. But kids in this age range get that symbolic thought ability and their language soars, but the thought doesn't catch up with their language yet. In fact, they can talk about things that they don't understand fully. They can answer questions in ways that might satisfy parents, but that they don't really get. And they can sound like they get a lot of things that they don't. So it's important to remember that their memory and language can sound logical, but they aren't really logical yet. And an example of this would be, they've moved out of a dog representing just the family pet. And so a 2 to 6 year old can tell you what a dog is. They can label a picture of a dog. If you give them a picture of a dog and a picture of a cat, they can tell you which one is a dog and a cat. But if you sit down with a kid in this age range and you say, tell me what's the difference between a dog and a cat, they're going to struggle. Some of them may have some language that's been offered to them, but they can't really dig in with the logic and say, well, one has this and the other has this. One does this type of thing, the other one, this is how one sounds, this is how the other sounds, and start to analyze back and forth. Analysis in the brain takes logical process. Well, if they don't have logical process and they can't analyze, that means they can't really analyze their own behaviors either. So asking a 2 to 6 year old, and quite frankly, we'll talk about this later, but asking any kid why they did something, rarely are you going to get an effective and actual answer. In older years, there's a bit of a difference for that. But in younger years, they really just can't analyze their own thoughts and behaviors to be able to give you an answer for why they did something. The primary things that get in the way of logic in thinking at this stage of life are concepts that Piaget brought up that are helpful to know because they tell us about how a brain's functioning at this age. And if we know how brains function at this age, how we interact with those kids and with those brains changes significantly too. So one thing is called centration. And centration is a focus on one aspect of a situation with the, to the exclusion of all others. Have you ever noticed that kids at this age can get really hyper-focused on things? But it's not just hyper-focused on activities or toys. It's also on concepts. So this is the stage where you hear babies say things like, really early toddlers or young toddlers, no, that's my daddy. And maybe another sibling will say, well, it's my daddy too. And they will say, no, it's my daddy. Because in their brains, daddy belonging to me is at the exclusion of him belonging to anybody else. There's not the logical process that he can be my dad and also someone else's dad. Kids at this age struggle to understand how dad can also be a son. Because if you're a dad, you're not a son. I'm the son or I'm the daughter, right? So that's a tough one. And because of that centration, also the self is at the center of everything. So we say that kids at this age are very egocentric. Now, egocentric and selfishness are not the same thing. Egocentrism is the processing of the world only through my own experience. And because kids have logic, don't have logical processes, and they don't really have abstract thinking at this point, they can't process the world through somebody else's experience, which means at this age, they can learn empathic behavior, but they don't really fully understand and grasp empathy. At this level, they can learn elements of it like compassion and attunement and listening and responding. And this is the stage where we teach the beginning behavior so that as they gain the brain development for empathy, they can fully connect to empathy as a way to engage with others. But they're just not at this point. Now, it doesn't mean that they're just selfish. A lot of kids are selfish. That's part of it too. But egocentrism and selfishness are not the same thing. Kids at this stage in their brain have a focus on appearance. And what that means is that a thing is whatever it appears to be. And so this is why a child will just say out loud whatever they see. They might call someone, fat, or insist that someone is a boy because they have a short hair, or is a girl because they have long hair, because what something looks like is the essence of what something is. And the idea that could be not true is a space that their brains just have a hard time going. Another process is called static reasoning. And this is where kids at this age believe that the world is what it is. It is stable and unchanging. And so they don't realize things like their parents were children at some point kind of surprises them. Or they really have a hard time imagining that as a process, that you were a child at one point. Or they may agree with it. Yeah, you were a kid. But it doesn't really fully hit them, and they can't fully process that you had a full childhood and experiences the same things that they did in similar fashion that they are, because they just can't go there. It's just that part of their brain's not unlocked. And finally, another aspect is conservation. And conservation is that things may be the same even if they look different. And the way that they measured this, and what you can even do with kids in this age range a lot of times, you can take two clear different size cups and fill one with water, and then in front of them, show them the one with the water in it, and and have another cup that's the same size as that with water in it too. So they look the exact same. So maybe you have two small, short, round glasses and you have about an inch of water in each one. And you ask them which one has more water and they will tell you the amount of water is the same. Then if in front of them you take a more longer cylindrical vase or a longer even cylindrical cup that's clear and they can see through and you pour the water into there and so it grows by about a half an inch because it is a smaller or skinnier container. And then you ask the child which one has more water in it, which one has more, they will tell you the one with the taller amount of water. They don't have the brain process that says the amount of water was the same, so it's still the same. And so when you look at that, that sounds really complicated, and in some ways it is, but it's just important to know that things aren't translating in kids' brains the way that it does in adult brains, and they can't make the jumps and transitions that we do. So when we expect for them to, it's not going to happen. It can cause issues altogether and frustration and shut down learning. One of the most powerful pieces of learning for kids during this stage is social learning. It is watching people and what they do. Now, kids also have a tendency to over imitate what's happening. So whatever they see adults doing or whatever they're taught to do, they're going to do it that way. One research study showed that if they watched an adult open a box that had a push button on it, but they used a wand and they waved it over three times and then pushed the button with the wand, if the kids were given the box and the wand, they would open the box the same way, where kids who had not seen an adult do that, if they were given the wand and the box and told to open the box, they'll just push the button to open it. And so kids will imitate things they see, even if it is not the better thing to do or the more logical and best thing to do, especially at this age group. And so remembering and recognizing that kids are copying and watching us is one of the most valuable things that we can do. With psychosocial development, Erickson stages that I talked about in the last one with trust versus mistrust, there's actually two that come into this age range. The second stage is autonomy versus shame and doubt, and it starts around 18 months and lasts until about 3. And you can see it in toddlers because what they really are trying to decide is if they can self-govern and be autonomous. And if the answer to that is no, they develop shame and doubt about their abilities, and that can continue into adulthood as well. And so the favorable outcome of this stage, if they can do things like toilet training and other types of independent behaviors, then they come out of this stage with a sense of self-control and adequacy. But if they don't, they can feel a lot of shame and self-doubt. And again, that can translate later as their brain continues to develop to other elements and other things that they're dealing with. An example of this and how this could affect someone long-term, in children who maybe had a sibling born very quickly after them, a lot of times parents will get the older child, even if they're still quite young, weaned and toilet trained as quickly as possible so that they can be as independent as possible so that there's space for taking care of the new baby, because having two in diapers and on bottles, it's a lot, right? Those kids, long-term, when they are expediting that process, tend to be high producers. They tend to be very autonomous and be able to produce things on their own and be a self-starter and have a lot of initiative. But they also sometimes can struggle with more shame as an adult if they aren't able to follow through on the things that they really want to do and it's not coming together like they want to. The third stage that happens starts about age 3 and it goes until about 5 or 6. The stage is called initiative versus guilt, and kids determine if they can undertake new activities and start new things, and they feel accomplished and proud, or they feel guilty. And through this process, they learn how to balance. A lot of this stage is about learning how to balance my emotions, my body, my thought processes, my decisions. In initiative versus guilt, the favorable outcome is that ability to self-start and take initiative in actions and activities. You'll hear kids at 3, 4, and 5 say, let's color, let's do this, I want to build this. And they are starting to generate these things that they want to do and be in charge of. But an unfavorable outcome would be a sense of guilt and inadequacy to be on one's own. And so people can struggle being alone or doing things alone if they struggle in this stage of development. So kids at this age learn how to negotiate and connect with peers through social play. One thing that I thought was interesting and might be helpful to bring up is that play is so vital at this stage because it helps them form relationships, especially lateral relationships. And there's an interesting dynamic even in generational differences that we see now, because the age group of really middle schoolers up through college and young adults, we call them Gen Z, those who were born in the range of about 1995 till about 2010, are the first generation of people that social scientists and researchers call homebound. They were raised primarily at home. It's the first generation of kids who didn't play outside as much, who didn't run around neighborhoods. They grew up in a world that was perceived to be more unsafe than what all of their parents before grew up in. As a result, they learned nearly all of their negotiation and language skills with their parents rather than with peers. And so there wasn't as much of a distinguish between how you speak to an adult and how you speak to other children. With that, we hear more people describe Gen Z as disrespectful because the way that they speak to adults does not change in the way that they speak to children. There's not real differentiation from that, even as people grow up. And they are also more likely to ask a lot of questions that they don't need to, because more time spent with parents meant that they had more directives and they were required to do more in line with what the parents wanted, and that they weren't negotiating laterally with peers. And so that peer-to-peer play and development is important. And while that's not a life ruiner, it absolutely is influential. And it's something that I have ended up even training groups on in university settings and other places to help them navigate educating and hiring Gen Z as adults. Parenting at this stage with discipline, parents really have a lot to decide with discipline. You have to decide what the point of discipline is, if it's a quick response or a long-term change in growth, if it's a connecting process or an attention-getting interaction, if it's guidance or control. Punishments that are designed to control and get immediate results, whether they're physical or psychological, rarely promote the long-term outcomes that I hear parents want. So things like physical punishment, especially when it's excessive and with older children, results in oftentimes more aggression in the kids themselves. And psychological control methods like shame and guilt have long-lasting issues, including mental health issues and decreased learning, kind of brain shutting down. And so parents have to be really conscientious, because that we can have a tendency too to back off and not want to discipline or guide, but kids need discipline and guidance. And by discipline, I mean corrective action and direction at this time so much, because there's so much that is being laid as a foundation for the rest of their life, but it does have to be balanced as well. They're learning to balance. The discipline has to be balanced too. All good discipline takes a lot of time and energy and attention. It's not quick, and kids will misbehave. It's what they do. And so in all cases, this stage is primed for early learning to transition into life maps for health of body, mind, and soul and relationships. And our guidance for our kids at this stage sets the framework for the rest of their life, in ways that we can't even fully understand how it could all impact them. So I encourage you to consider your discipline measures and how you're doing things. And there's so much out there to learn from and to gain if you need some guidance and some additional direction in that area. I hope you'll tune in for the next episode that's on middle childhood, addressing ages 6 to 11. Thank you so much for listening to Remodel Parenting. If you know someone who could benefit from this episode, I hope you'll share it with them. And if you love what we're doing, like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have topics you'd like to hear about, email us at info@theremodelproject.com.